Friends, I would like to take our microphones now to the Irish Consulate in New York and the Consul General of Ireland, Kieran Madden, who hails actually from Cork. Kieran, you're very welcome to the program.
Thanks, Adrian. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Tell us a little bit about yourself and growing up in Ireland. I won't ask you when, but where, and what are your earliest reflections, you know, of growing up in the Emerald Isle?
God, I suppose the world was a very small place for me. I grew up in the 70s and 80s in Cork City. And looking back on it, it's just how little of the world we knew, how little of the world we even considered knowing. You know, the end of the road was far away. The next parish was almost unthinkable. The next parish was an adventure. So we were very narrow in our experience, really, compared to kids these days who can just see the whole world with the click of a button, which is obviously far better. And then, of course, the other thing, looking back on it, is how homogenous it all was.
Yeah. When did you choose the career, or did you ease into the Foreign Service, the Government Foreign Service? Was that a choice of 1, 2, 3, 4 career choices as you were, you know, as you were entering coming out of college in Ireland?
When I was in college, I was studying history, but mainly foreign policy history, and the idea of being in the Foreign Service sounded terribly exciting and probably fancy in a way, and I kind of set it as a goal. And, you know, a bit then, like, out your marks, you get inside and you're going, oh, is this what's inside? You know, the idea in the head before you do it is always different to reality. Now, the reality is fantastic, and the reality is a privilege, but it is. Yeah, that was something I kind of thought I'd like to do it, and was then surprised when it came through.
Yeah. You know, a week from now, there's a huge event. There's an election for the UN Security Council, which, in fact, I know this is not your particular area, but...
Yeah.
Tell us about, you know, the significance of Ireland's, you know, placement, and what does it actually mean, particularly in light of, you know, all of the massive changes, some of them, you know, coming overnight, and others that have been around. What is the seat on the Security Council, and why is Ireland, you know, mad to get it?
Not only is Ireland mad to get it, Ireland will get it. So there's an election on Wednesday, the 17th.
Okay.
And it is Ireland, Norway, and Canada running for 2 seats of the UN Security Council, and every UN member has 2 votes. And Ireland launched a campaign for election. We announced that we would run many years ago. We launched a campaign here in New York on the 2nd of July 2018. So it was the Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, the Taoiseach, to Simon Coveney, Bono, and of course our ambassador to the United Nations, Geraldine Byrne-Nathan, launched the campaign in the UN garden just under 2 years ago. And I suppose the 3 themes that are kind of picked out as part of the campaign are empathy, independence, and partnership. And each of these drills down. So I suppose Ireland at the UN Security Council is such a fundamental chamber where discussions happen that shape the future of the world and deal with issues challenging the global order at any given time. And Ireland would bring an independent voice to that table. It would bring a voice of small nations to that table. And given our own history in terms of the Great Famine, our history of colonization.
Yeah.
That's where the empathy piece comes. So these challenges still exist in some parts of the world, but we have been through some of this, and we can share experience on that. And then also Ireland has demonstrated its commitment to addressing these kinds of issues for decades through with the longest continuous member of peacekeeping, so a participant in UN peacekeeping, Ireland is, and then our overseas aid program is consistently ranked as one of the best, most effective in the world. So we put our money where our mouth is, we put our people where our mouth is, and for Ireland to take the seat from 1 January next year, I think would be really, really important. I think we would make an enormous contribution at that table.
I gather from you that you have a feeling that that Ireland is very well positioned for this, and that brings us back actually to that the famous launch in the garden of the United Nations here in New York. It was a great launch itself, and there wasn't the level of confidence that then it was being rolled out, but it was so important that it was worth campaigning for, and it was one hell of a campaign.
It was a hell of a campaign. Sorry, Carl Crossy, go on. Sorry, Adrian.
No, I want you to... Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I suppose what I'm saying here is that Ireland should be. I don't want to add any more pressure to colleagues who are working day and night to help win this election. And anyone who ever runs for election in anything, whether it's in school or whether it's for government, knows you can't count on the votes until they're counted after the fact. So I don't want to add pressure. Yeah. But I'm saying Ireland has this remarkably strong case to make, and leaders in Ireland, political leaders and public service, other public service leaders, have gone around the world making that case.
Yes.
So the campaign has been strong, the message is strong, and the message is strong because it is anchored in reality. And the campaign led here in New York by Geraldine Bernathan has just been phenomenal, a huge effort. So should we be successful on Wednesday? I mean, it will go down to people working really, really hard at having a fundamental message, fundamentally positive message to sell about Ireland.
Is the agenda set, or do you get selected? Does the country get selected first, and then draft the agenda? Because it's a relatively short period of time. What is it, a year or a couple?
Two years. So 2021 and 2022, full calendar years. It's a combination. So a lot of the agenda items are kind of recurring agenda items. Then obviously the Security Council must react to events in the world as they happen. And then if Ireland were to be successful, I think it's expected that we would end up chairing the council for one or two months over the 2 year period. And I think then there's opportunity to bring some issues forward. But the bulk of it is an existing agenda because it's about reacting to events in the world and reacting to situations in the world. And it's but reacting in the best possible way to those.
My guest friends, the Consul General of Ireland and New York here in Madden. I want to do a little flashback to the lead up to St. Patrick's Day, and I suppose when history is recording this year and the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York, the oldest and largest parade anywhere in the world, we will remember as well the huge disappointments that came our way in tandem with the coronavirus and whatever, but on the lead up to St. Patrick's Day, there was a first in the Irish Consulate, led indeed by yourself, where the African American Irish Diaspora Network was actually launched. And perhaps you will, tell us when I say it was a first, never did we think that you know, that the Irish government and indeed the consulate would, you know, highlight or tackle, you know, a topic. If it wasn't taboo, it wasn't, you know, no attention had been paid to, you know, the reality of the great affiliation and association, you know, of the African American history and their Irish association. What was the impetus that had you single-handedly take that on board?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. The first thing is not single-handedly. The African American Irish Diaspora Network, I mean, is set up by a group of people, some of whom you'd know. Miriam Nyhan, of course,
yeah.
known to your listeners, Dr. Miriam Nyhan, Dr. Lenwood Sloan, a choreographer and academic from Pittsburgh, who is African-American, Irish-American, Dennis Brownlee in Washington, D.C., and a number of others. So they are the board of the African-American Irish Diaspora Network. I'd say I've had a supporting role and hopefully a catalytic supporting role in that network, and we continue to be supportive, but it belongs to them. You know, a pasty-faced guy from Cork isn't the best person to be representing African-America or diaspora. But if I can wind it back a bit further, I arrived here just under 3 years ago. And in the first year, or 18 months, I was really knocked over by how almost every event I attended or hosted or spoke at was almost exclusively white audiences. And, you know, in some ways it seemed understandable to me, the Irish America, etc., but it just seemed very odd that in New York City, in the United States, those were the audiences. So I started digging around a little bit and found that many others had done work in this area. And so two numbers are important. There are various estimates about how many members of the African American community have Irish heritage. You're aging between 30% and 38% of that. And some of that, of course, we know goes back to difficult, dark history and bad episodes, but a lot of it doesn't. It was just normal human interactions along the way. And then the other number that's important is that one in six people in Ireland were not born on the island of Ireland. So we're a changed country as well. So the audiences I was seeing here were not even representative of Ireland, the Ireland I had left to come here.
Yeah.
So those are the two impetuses. And then if you see that, you know, 30%+ of African Americans have Irish heritage. Why are we not seeing them at our events? And you dig down, and you know, there's an awful lot of history there, some good and some bad. And our goal, I suppose, really is to at least make sure that anyone who feels they have Irish heritage feels welcome at our events. Anyone who doesn't have Irish heritage is welcome also, but that anyone with any Irish heritage should feel welcome at our events. And then with that, we have to explore the history in a serious fashion. You know, we can't just go pick up the positive bits of the Irish-American, African-American intersections and the Irish-African-American intersections. We must also look at the dark bits, you know, were the Irish people involved in slavery? Of course there were. And let's drill down and own our history for good and for bad. And that way, we can set a platform to move forward together in a positive way. And the launch itself was just a wonderful event here in the consulate of residence.
Yeah.
It was really positive. We had the fantastic, the people there, most of the people in the room were African-American with Irish heritage, African-American, Irish-Americans. But the range of people, there were bankers, there were academics, there were musicians, there were actors, there were public servants. It was just a real slice through society that also happened to have these other two African-American and Irish-American kind of qualifiers. And there was a sense of excitement and positivity. And in one way, we're absolutely delighted that the launch happened before the COVID lockdown happened. Of course, the other downside of it is that the launch happened and then the world hit pause for a period. So even this week I was talking to Dennis Brownlee, who's the chairman of the network, and looking ahead to the autumn and what might be possible to do then, and let's keep the momentum going in this. And this work of breaking down barriers, it's going to be long work. I'll be here for a few years and I'll be gone and other people will move through. It's a work of years, it's probably the work of decades, but it's really, really important work to undertake. You know, we wouldn't be having this conversation if there weren't problems of racism. So let's try to take a lead, right, at least within our own communities, make sure that we can show a lead in trying to eliminate that.
Tell us a little bit about this Dennis Brownlee and how he became that interested, as in fact he did, in his Irish heritage. How did he look at that and say, okay, I want to look into this? Was his a casual of casual interest in his Irishness? Was it something that he was that bothered him? That was that something that he felt that he undertook. Where was his motivation, and how did he get into?
God, I'd hate to speak to anyone else's motivation, and Dennis told me his own history, but I'm afraid of actually recounting it incorrectly and giving a bad representation. I'm sure he'd be happy to come and talk on the show at some point also. But what I would say, at least from where we are now, is that his isn't a casual interest. You know, he's very passionate about trying to explore these links. He really wants to bring the links alive. So, for example, right now he's looking towards September, October of this year represents the 150th anniversary of Frederick Douglass's visit to Ireland. And obviously it's a much written about, a much celebrated visit. And he sees that as an opportunity, Dennis, and the wider board of the network see that as an opportunity to, again, catalyse more support around these efforts and get more interest, build more excitement. I know he'd like to kind of bring people to Ireland, to places that Frederick Douglass visited. But that mightn't be possible in the COVID context, but at least, build up the energy behind all of this. But Dennis is certainly, I can't say exactly how it started, apart from the fact that he knows about his Irishness for a long time, but his interest now is far from casual. He's very, very passionate and purposeful with it.
Yeah, and of course the coverage and the contribution of Dr. Miriam Nyhan Gray through, for our audience, through the program, which is extremely very popular, and we present it here on Irish radio.
Dr. Nyhan Gray has done fantastic work on this for a long time, and one of the things she's doing right now is Black, Brown and Green, which is a collection of oral histories of non-white Irish Americans. And the stories that are coming out in that are just fantastic. They really are. One person telling their story of how the lighter-skinned cousins effectively had an American wake in their home city because they were leaving to go to the white side of the city.
Yeah.
Because they weren't going to see them anymore. These stories, and that was the 1960s. And these stories are heartbreaking. But the reaction to Dr. Nyhan Gray's oral histories, both from those who have been interviewed and those who hear the interviews, is just phenomenal. She really doing, and again, I think she knows, we all know, it's tip of the iceberg, but she's the one who said, let's start at the tip and keep on going down and find more. And she does phenomenal work on it.
We also, and first of all, the oral archive at Glucksman Ireland House are a treasure beyond description. They will forever and a day be so significant in Irish history, and indeed as the Centre for Irish Studies, the most popular in the United States. This is very much a part of the undertaking of creating that oral history, and particularly in the environment that we are living in, the African Irish American connection. is just something that, indeed, I know that Dr. Miriam, has brought it a long way. And as we say, it wasn't a once-off. This is something that was very much in the works and, you know, on the lead-up again to St. Patrick's Day. I wanted to also perhaps mention a couple of other people like Mick Maloney, a musicologist from Limerick, who has, you know, as we look back, Mick Maloney actually took another segment of our history through music, and that was so revealing in terms of you know, the Irish influence, the Irish connection, and indeed the African American history through music, through song, through dance. This was something also that was, you know, very strange and foreign to all of us who, on many occasions, feel quite comfortable, you know, in living in our own world without any sense of, you know, the level of knowledge or not that we have with respect to aspects of our history, including, of course, the African American very tangible history that is there.
Well, yeah, they say Mick Maloney has done fantastic work on it, and his, often when he presents on it, his partner in presentation is Linwood Sloan, the choreographer, who brings demonstrates the same connections on in dance and music. And Mick Maloney was the first person to tell me about the history of, you know, the history of the banjo coming as a West African instrument to the United States and then being imported from the United States to Ireland, where it became an integral part of traditional music there. So these connections are there. And the more you dig, even scratching the surface, you come across more and more connections. I mean, I have here in front of me on the desk an academic paper on Irish and African-American interracial marriage in New York City's 8th Ward in 1870. Yeah. Now, that's a pretty narrow slice of life, but it shows the connections were there, the connections are deep, the connections are long-standing. And then you come across some surprising ones, like Marcus Garvey in Madison Square Garden in 1920, August 1920, in the middle of Ireland's War of Independence, reading out his telegram to Eamon de Valera, "Keep up the fight for a free Ireland." So there are all these unusual connections along the way, the more you dig. But I'd say we have to, you know, there's lots of really positive connections, but we have to own the bad with the good as we explore it, because that's the only way you can move forward.
Yeah, it's a huge undertaking, and it is one that, as I say, this was not a reaction to the coronavirus and then the horrific murder of George Floyd that indeed woke up the world to how insane things were, that a lot of us figured, well, you know, that stuff happens anyway. It is something, but I would like to ask you about a figure I wouldn't have thought of, very few of us, is that 1 in 6 residents of Ireland, citizens of Ireland, are not from Ireland. And how did that play into the economics of Ireland through a period came rapidly? But tell us a little bit about that, and that what contributed to that.
Well, so that goes back to what you were saying at the very start when you were asking me about my youth. You know, Ireland was a very homogenous place when I was growing up, and you know, in Cork, and I'm sure when you were growing up in Mayo, the same applied there. And I suppose since the 1990s, there's been a lot of inward migration into Ireland, and it's a huge change. It's a change for the better. You know, diversity is always good, but we also have to learn how to deal with it. We have to make sure that we learn from places that have dealt with it before. And, you know, the last few weeks, again, in the context of the murder of George Floyd, racism is being explored everywhere, and you see more and more reports of racist incidents in Ireland. So we have to learn how to deal with that and eradicate that, and we have to learn from places that are further along this curve than we are. But overall, it is just a wonderfully positive contribution to Ireland that it is becoming so much more diverse than it was. It'll challenge our thinking, challenge our way of looking at the world, and build up our connections with the world. Now, at the same time, when I say 1 in 6, a huge portion of that 1 in 6 who weren't born on the island will be from Europe.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are people from Asia, from Africa, from the United States, and so it's not the numbers and the demographic breakdown isn't the same as it is here. But it's all challenging. It means that there's new food in Ireland. There's new music in Ireland. There's shops, yes. You know, there are shops where other languages other than English and Irish are spoken, and that it just adds to the richness of the country and makes us. It better integrates us in the world by bringing the world into Ireland, I suppose.
Yeah, many would, you know, say that the reason or the primary reason. That Ireland, you know, welcomed, so many people who came from different countries, they were welcomed more because they were needed. Ireland was, booming with the Celtic Tiger, and a lot of Irish people no longer settled for menial work, work that doesn't pay well. Come on over. You're very welcome. And maybe with the help of God, you go home when things get better here. I'm being facetious, but by the same token, isn't there some degree of truth to that? It wasn't that Ireland, held up a sign saying, come one, come all. It was born out of a need, and that tolerance was very closely associated with the economy of Ireland.
Look, absolutely. The reality is that Ireland's economy transformed from the early 90s onwards, and it became, the economic argument is a two-way one. It's not just that the economy needed more workers, it's also that those workers wanted those jobs. You know, there is people came to Ireland because there was work there. People came to Ireland because there was good quality of life there. So it's a two-way push and pull factors in that. That's one part of it. The other, of course, is that being part of the single market, and this is a different argument again. Ireland is part of one giant labour market, which is the European Union. Workers are free to move from one country to another to take up employment. And that means that, in US companies, for example, investing in Ireland, they can attract talent from anywhere in Europe without any immigration issues, without any visa issues. It's just people can move straight and to work, and that means that specific skills and language skills and other technical skills can be attracted to a job in Dublin or Galway or Cork or Mayo or wherever. But I think, by and large, Ireland has embraced. So the economic factors are a huge part of it, of course they are. And it wasn't a give me, you're poor, you're hungry message of, late 19th century United States. But at the same time, I think Ireland has largely embraced the change that has come with it. Because it does, Ireland is a more exciting place because of it. There are more. But yeah, the diversity has shaken us up a bit, and it's a good thing. And I'd say it's a lot better place than growing up in a homogenous 1980s Cork.
Kieran, if we go back and pluck out from our own history not necessarily Irish history, but on the American history, a lot of that history will record that some of the prejudice, that some of the had to do with competition for jobs, for the Irish who came from again from a history of oppression, famine, and all of the needs that we recognize, that actually a lot of the competition did breed prejudice, and it had very little to do with color. Had to do, you know, with you know, the fear that somebody would be breaking into what we thought was our area of progress and survival.
No, absolutely. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't give any credence to the, you know, the kind of nonsensical idea that the indentured servants were the equivalent of slavery. But at the same time, if the freed men and women in the northern United States in the 1840s and 50s were the bottom rung of the socioeconomic ladder, next rung up was probably the Irish. And of course, that would be competition. And there are two quotes from Frederick Douglass, you know, that kind of almost illustrate this. When he visited Ireland, he said, "One of the most pleasing features of my visit thus far has been the total absence of all manifestations of prejudice against me on account of my colour." So he was so pleased at his reception in Ireland. But then, about the Irish in America, he said, "Perhaps no class of our fellow citizens has carried this prejudice against colour to a point more extreme and dangerous than have our Catholic Irish fellow citizens." And he concludes that quote by saying, they are taught that he eats the bread that belongs to them. So what he's saying there, I suppose, is that competition was almost being fanned by others as well. But there's no doubt that that was at the root of a lot of prejudice and difficulty. And you look then at the draft riots during the Civil War, which are so kind of memorably recorded in Peter Quinn's novel, Banished Children of Eve. So all that is there. And so through the African-American Irish Diaspora Network and other initiatives, we have to explore all that and tease it out, as I say, take the bad with the good on it.
And it sure beats cherry picking.
Cherry picking, of course, it's very easy for us to kind of look at, you know, some of Frederick Douglass's great quotes about being in Ireland, how wonderful he was received. But if you do that, you can't ignore what he said about the Irish in America. You have to take the whole. And it's the only way, that kind of honest exploration of it, is the only way we can move forward. And if I can drag it like that for a moment, this year is the 150th anniversary of Douglas's visit to Ireland. This year is also the 150th anniversary of the 175th anniversary, and it's also the 175th anniversary of the onset of the Great Famine in Ireland, which of course is transformational story of both Ireland and Irish America. It's the foundation, I suppose, really, of modern Irish America. So we take that as a starting point and try to understand our history from then forward and understand those histories in parallel and the intersections. There's a lot of work and there's a lot to unpack.
Yeah.
And it's only worth doing if we do it in a serious way. But we can do so. And there's enough enthusiasm out there. And as you say, this work was underway before the murder of George Floyd and all that has followed from that, but maybe we capture the impetus that exists because of that and try to, you know, direct more energy into this work.
Well, we definitely know at several levels, and I don't know that this is peculiar to the Irish, but there are so many areas, and indeed we're pretty good added ourselves when you when I don't know about Cork, but when we were growing up, there was little or no reference to the famine at all. It was and that had to do more with the fact that particularly up in our neck of the woods, there was survivor guilt that basically that tied with our religion. It was not a topic to be discussed. And they all lived happily ever after. There was a cut off there. And the excuse, perhaps it is indeed true, that at that period we're talking about, you know, just 100 years after the famine. So it wasn't so much that it was a shameful topic, but rather one that came again with a lot of emotions, and the best way to deal with it, you know, was, you know, to say a prayer and move on.
Well, yes, Irish and the Irish and dealing with emotion, moving on is generally the best way. We were taught to deal with that. But you've done so much. I don't mean this as flattery, Adrian, but I mean it's factually. You, along with partners, have done so much to bring the memory and the history of the famine alive in New York, including with the Great Hunger Memorial down in Battery Park City.
I'm very proud of it. But again, as you reacted in the beginning, that was I was one of so many people who, you know, felt that this was something that we should be doing, and from there it took off. The whole story of the famine, and as we saw, again, I've mentioned this many times before, that growing up in the national school in Ireland, the grammar school, our history, and Irish history in particular, brought us right up to about 1916, and then if you went on to higher education, you'd learn about the rest of it. A lot of it did have to do with, became very personal, and we could criticize the curriculum, what should have been, but it was all very understandable. Because of the times that were in it. It would be interesting as we move forward to see how differently the current situation is with diversity, how that is going to be handled now, because that also was kept on the back burner. So it's a new day and perhaps long overdue. I thank you for joining us, and I still say that it was, and you're the first Consul General who actually, Irish Consul General here, who took the bull by the horns when, in fact, it would be so much easier particularly coming up to St. Patrick's Day and the St. Patrick's Day Parade, it would be a lot easier to focus on Irish history, on the St. Patrick's Day Parade, the tie with the Catholic Church, all of that, which we had and still do, which is all great, but. To bring that to the fore as part of a new recognition, as this being part of the Irish traditions here, and to kind of make that Oscail an Doras open the door to take on a project like that. You're the one who made the tea. And your good wife made the sandwiches. So
well, like, as I say, there are plenty of others who were involved in this now, and plenty of others who have been doing it for a long time. But I thought it was important that official Ireland also come in and take some of the responsibility on this. And, yeah, it's a necessary work. And I started mentioning it a few times from various podiums at events, and all of a sudden will come and find you afterwards and say they want to be involved. People are excited by it, and they know it's necessary, and they know it's important, and hopefully we can do some good with it.
Yes, well, again, congratulations on the fact that there are so many areas, and I don't know, but as we look back on the council's general, have done such tremendous work, not only in New York, but throughout the United States. I think we will remember this particular year and this particular event as something that we won't forget anytime soon. Can I ask you, though, before we leave, about the tremendous work and the Irish government involvement in taking care of to a much higher level because of the coronavirus, the support of, say, Sláinte, the metal, and just about every area in our society that, you know, that the Irish government is not just there in case. It is to the forefront in, again, providing tremendous services and support for those who really woke up one morning and their world had fallen apart.
Sláinte 2020 is a phenomenal initiative. It really is. The five organisations that have come together to run it. The Emerald, I'll probably forget one now, but the Ashling Irish Centre, the New York Irish Centre in Long Island City, the Emerald Isle Immigration Centre, United Irish Counties Association, and New York GAA have come together to support those who, as you say, their world fell apart when the COVID lockdown hit because their jobs were at an end and their income had dried up and they found themselves in dire straits. And the government have been, you know, I suppose, delighted, honoured to step in and give some financial support to Sláinte 2020 so that they can help others. Those five organisations, of course, are embedded in New York Irish society already.
Yeah.
They're embedded in the community. They understand the community. And we were delighted to be able to give them some assistance as they sought ways to help people at their quite possibly their lowest ebb. It's individuals and families are being helped. We also gave some support to the Solace House, which, of course, is a counselling service because, depending on people's supports people have around them, this can be a very challenging period
yeah.
for people's mental health. And there's been support in other cities as well, in Chicago, in Boston, I know of, I think possibly also in the Bay Area. I'm not sure about that. But look, the group that came together to set up and run Sláinte 2020 have just done phenomenal work, necessary work, and it just again shows a phenomenal coming together of the Irish community for each other at a time of need in the city. I mean, I know before my time here there was Hurricane Sandy and the community came together.
Yeah.
This is the next big collective mettle that people stand up for each other and with each other. And I just want to thank them for all the work they have done, and we hopefully can continue to support them.
I think it is fair, though, to point out that the Irish government was not sitting in the wings waiting for something as major and as horrific as this plague that hit us, because the tradition has been, you know, the Irish government, going back a couple of decades, have always not just given the wink and the nod or the to those, you know, who are suffering, to the immigrants. They were particularly sensitive to the need to be there, not to be wait to be called upon, but to get behind.
Absolutely. I mean, since 2015, the government, through the consulate, have given almost $4 million to welfare organizations in New York to support the community through the Immigrant Support Program. So it is long-standing support, and most of those organizations that I mentioned were already partners with us in supporting the community. But then, of course, when the need becomes more acute, we need to be able to act quickly,
yes.
And luckily we were able to do so.
Kieran Madden, who is the Consul General of Ireland, and somebody indeed who has his hands full, as with a lot of the great number of representatives of the Irish government. Thank you for being with us today. And also, we have mentioned a couple of times Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray, who again has made tremendous strides with, of course, her team at Glucksman Ireland House. And it has been a privilege for us for many years to actually have Dr. Miriam Nyhan-Gray with her own program here on Saturday mornings. It's tremendous, and we as we look forward and not sure what the new normal is, I think that the strength and the tradition, the metal tradition of the Irish getting together, to help the neighbor's child, is something that we can be very proud of. But for the Irish government and for the Irish government contribution, we are indeed most grateful, and thank you for continuing to do what is very necessary in tough times.
No, thanks for the warm welcome this morning, and we'll hopefully talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Stay safe.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. And friends there, the Consul General of Ireland, who's done such an amazing job and continues to do it. We are going to